Good afternoon. It's a great pleasure. A great pleasure to be with you again. What I want to speak about today is tzedakah, some of the details of charity, and what you should and should not do. But before I come to that, let me ask you whether you have any halachic issues of a pressing nature which should be addressed first. Any pressing? Yeah. It's so good to have friends with whom one can have an interesting conversation. A city is only a gallery of pictures without friendship.
And you told me something quite surprising. He said that he was homosexual. And so more conversations. And out of that came two questions that I wanted to ask you. The first is that if he decides to get married, does he have to disclose his sexual orientation? And the second is, not to get married, what are the practical halachas that he has to be concerned with on a day-to-day basis?
Question number one. Someone who is gay, homosexual, if he's going to get married to a woman, does he have to disclose his sexual orientation prior to marriage? Let's talk about this before we come to the second question. I don't know very much about homosexuality, but one thing seems fairly clear. Of course, what strikes me as being fairly clear today might be disproven tomorrow, I don't know. But let us for a moment assume that I am right in my perception of things. There is a spectrum of sexuality. There are men who are at one end of the spectrum and are attracted only by women. There are men at the other end of the spectrum who are attracted only by other men. And then there are people who are at different spaces along the spectrum who might be attracted by either men or women, more by men, more by women, all spectrum out there. Now, if we're talking about someone who is repelled, someone who is repulsed by women, someone who finds women to be repulsive, then why on earth would he want to get married? Sounds like a big mistake, and he just shouldn't do it. And why on earth would a woman want to marry such a person? It's not a question of should he disclose it and then go ahead with the marriage. Well, he shouldn't go ahead with the marriage at all. Now, if on the other hand, he does find women attractive, then there's no particular reason to oppose the marriage. Should he reveal the fact? It depends where on the spectrum he is. If it's going to pose a problem in the future marriage, then of course it has to be disclosed. If, on the other hand, it's only a mild attraction to men and is not going to affect the marriage at all, then there's no reason to disclose it. The answer to the question, must he disclose his sexual leanings, depends entirely upon how strong those leanings are and what his relationship with women might be. And that's a wide spectrum of thought. Of course, I'm a man who finds women repulsive. There's no particular reason to get married at all, and well, it would be a mistake to get married. But then on the second question, I've already forgotten. My short-term memory loss has affected me. What was the second question? Well, of course, men have a mitzvah of the Torah, of priorivia. Men have a mitzvah of the Torah of producing children, and that's from the Torah point of view. The main reason, by no means the only reason, but the main reason to get married, so as to fulfill that mitzvah. You don't have to be a great rabbinic scholar to understand onus rahmana patre. If you can't do a mitzvah, so you can't do the mitzvah. And all sorts of people find themselves in situations where they are unable to fulfill certain mitzvahs. If that's the case with the gay person, then, well, if you can't, you can't. And that's all there is to it. Of course, he's potter and not required to do that. What does he have to be careful about on a day-to-day basis? Well, like anyone else, a life of Kedusha, a life of Torah, demands of us to avoid erotic stimulation when we are going about our daily affairs, and he would have to do this as well. Whatever he finds erotically stimulating, of course, he should avoid. Beyond that, I'd rather deal with it on a case-by-case basis. What does that mean?
Exactly.
Yeah, so the Shulman Nagi is not a halachically defined term. It's not a, there is no such thing. What is wrong, of course, is to engage in any interaction with other people which is erotically stimulating. The normal thing is between boys and girls, but a man who finds other men erotically stimulating, he should avoid those situations in which he will find himself erotically stimulated, just like a man should avoid similar situations with a woman. It's the same. Yeah.
Could you shed some light on the issue the aspect that some people sometimes you hear that people say there's a Torah prohibition. It sounds like a Torah prohibition is more strict than a rabbinic prohibition.
Sure.
And but also then I learned a few times already that rabbinic prohibitions are even more important, more strict than
of course, Torah law, positive commandments and negative commandments of Torah origin, of course, are weightier and stricter than rabbinically legislated law. After all, the basic principle, which might not apply in every case, it doesn't apply in every case, but the basic principle is Safek Daraisa L'Chumra. If one is in a doubtful case about a Torah law, of course you have to be strict. You have before you something which might or might not be prohibited by Torah law, whether it's Kashrus or Shabbos or whatever it is, the prohibition might be of Torah origin, then of course you have to be strict. You don't want to run the risk of violating something which is a Torah prohibition. Safek Derabanan L'Kula, on the other hand, if what you have before you is a doubtful case, a dubious case, then maybe there's a rabbinic prohibition here, but surely no Torah prohibition. If it's only a question of maybe, Safek, a rabbinic prohibition, then that's L'Kula. One should be lenient in a case like that. Let me just point out in passing that in order for a Suffolk to be a Suffolk, what is a Suffolk? What is a doubt? Ein Zweifel in German. Ein Zweifel? Una duda in Spanish. Yes, una duda, a Suffolk. What is a Suffolk? Suffolk is something which exists not in reality. In reality, the food is either mutter or aser, permitted or prohibited. In reality, the activity on Shabbos is either permitted or prohibited, but I do not know which it is. The suffix exists not in reality. The suffix exists in my mind. And in order for a suffix to be a valid suffix in my mind, it must be a suffix which is irresolvable. It must be a doubt where I cannot find out the truth. If the truth is available, and I'm just too lazy to find out what the truth is, that's not a halachically acceptable suffix. A halachically acceptable suffix, which tells me to be lenient in rabbinic cases, is a suffix, a doubt where I cannot find out the truth.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what about what? Depends. The basic rule is as follows. If you tell someone a halacha which they are not going to observe, you have succeeded in transforming them from being shogeg, unwitting violators, into mazed, wanton violators. It's surely more severe to violate a halacha that you know you are violating, rather than to violate a halacha unwittingly, not realizing you're in violation. And therefore, if telling someone, tisk, 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 don't eat that, don't do this on Shabbos, such and such is prohibited by halacha, if they're going to do it anyway, so you've just made the situation worse. Before you told them, they were doing a relatively minor infraction because they didn't realize they were in violation of the law. Now that they know they are in violation, they're mazed, that's a much more severe violation. It would have been better, what you should have done, is kept quiet. And therefore, you should only tell them the halacha if you are reasonably sure that they're going to accept your words and abide by it. Now, this, of course, as Rav Moshe Feinstein points out in the published Tshuva, this principle does not apply to a teacher of halacha who is teaching halacha in a systematic way. If what I am doing is, if I'm engaging in an act of Talmud Torah, if I'm engaging in an act of learning Torah, instructing Torah to the people in a systematic way, today we're learning the halachas of Shabbos or whatever, well, I'm not telling people what to do and what not to do. What I'm doing is teaching the halacha in a systematic way, so it's correct to teach the halacha in a systematic way, even if you know full well that some of the audience is going to ignore your words. But if you're addressing a single individual regarding a specific point, it's better to be quiet rather than to reveal to him that he's doing something wrong, if you're sure he's going to continue doing the wrong thing. Yeah, of course, it's good to learn about it. Or shebetorah machzir lemutav. Learning Torah is the best way of doing tshuva. So, if the question is, should you learn about it? By all means, it's a mitzvah to learn about it, and that's what you should do. Yes. See. Si.
We're learning in the daily Rambam. Yesterday, we were reading about different situations where a kid was not valid, and therefore that could lead to a situation where a woman gets divorced, apparently gets divorced, but actually it didn't work because the kid didn't work, and she engages in relations with another man, thinking that she's getting married legitimately, and then it found out that the kid wasn't proper, and therefore the children are mundane, the children are born from the relations, she has to separate from that man, and she cannot go back to her previous husband. So the question is, in order for there to be a legitimate kiddush for a man and woman to be married, legitimate according to the Torah, let's say someone that gets married not in a prum, in a prum way, meaning to people in a conservative community, they get married not to prune, but still there is a king and they have relations. So are they married?
Yes. A Jewish man, Jewish woman who get married in a non-orthodox way, either with a conservative or a reform rabbi, or perhaps with no rabbi at all, perhaps with a judge in a civil marriage, the question arises as follows. According to some poskim, led by Rav Henkin, the greatest of the rabbanim of New York in the 20th century, the Rav, who Rav Moshe Feinstein himself considered to be the leading halakhic authority of New York. According to Rav Henkin, even if they had no ceremony at all, they were just living with each other as husband and wife. That's enough to make them halachically married. And if they wish to separate, they absolutely need a get. And without a get, if she marries someone else or has relations with someone else, the children will indeed be mamzerim. That's the opinion of Rav Henkin. Yeah, here comes the other opinion. The other opinion is that of Rav Moshe Feinstein himself. Rav Moshe Feinstein said like this: in order for a marriage to be halachically correct, in order for a marriage to be halachically valid, a number of things are required. We need mutual agreement. If he and she don't agree to get married, so there's not going to be any marriage. There's no such thing as forcing a marriage upon someone. You need an exchange of rings, or some other things will also can substitute for the exchange, not exchange of a ring, but giving of a ring, him to her. And the other thing you need are at least two witnesses. Now, witnesses, edim in halacha, serve different functions in different contexts. Sometimes halacha demands edim, witnesses, to be present, so that you will be able to prove later on what happened. If I lend you money, the reason you have to pay me back is because you borrowed the money. Even if it was in private and there were no witnesses present, the very fact that you borrowed it creates an obligation to repay the money. On the other hand, there might later be a disagreement between you and me, and if I can't prove that I lent you the money, then obviously I'm going to be in trouble. In such a case, I might want to have witnesses to the loan in order to be able to prove later on what happens. That's one function of witnesses, to be able to prove later on what happens. Another function of witnesses in other contexts: sometimes halacha demands witnesses not to be able to prove anything, but in order to make an act a valid halachic act. And that's true in this case. In order for a marriage to be a halachically valid act, there must be at least two witnesses present. In the absence of two witnesses, there is no marriage and nothing happens. Now, witnesses, in order to be halachic witnesses in this case, must be ritually acceptable witnesses. After all, we're not talking about witnesses whose reliability is going to be important at a later date. We're talking about witnesses whose presence is part of the ritual. In order to make the mitzvah work correctly, it must be done in the presence of these witnesses. These are ritual witnesses, having nothing to do with reliability, having nothing to do with being able to prove later on what happens. Among the requirements for these witnesses, it must be male, must be over the age of bar mitzvah. The two witnesses must not be related to each other. The two witnesses must not be related to the bride or the groom. The two witnesses must be Torah observant. There are many other requirements as well.
So that got my question. The question is, how does this break up from Hamas at all? That they get married in a conservative...
Without witnesses.
So without witnesses, or let's say with witnesses, but for sure the divorce, they don't do something prone. They just
we'll come to this. Now, according to Rav Moshe Feinstein, if there were no ritually acceptable witnesses at the time of the giving of the ring, then there is, from the halachic point of view, no marriage here at all. And therefore, they do not need a get if they separate. Now, that means that each individual non-Orthodox marriage is going to have to be investigated on its own merits. So sometimes it might have been a Reform marriage, but there might have been two Torah-observant men over the age of Bar Mitzvah standing there who observed the giving of the ring. Then maybe there were two witnesses. Probably not, but each case should be investigated on its own merits. If there were no two witnesses present, no get is required later. Now, even the children are their children. No. In order to produce a mamzer, it must be that it's impossible for him and her to marry. If it's impossible for him and her to marry, she's married to someone else, and it's an act of adultery, there's no way they could be married, that will produce mamzerim. A brother and sister in an incest case, there's no way they could be married, and therefore the children will be mamzerim. An ordinary Jewish man, an ordinary Jewish woman, who are not married, but could be, she's not married to anyone else at the moment, they could be married, the children are entirely kosher, and no problem at all. Now, if there are two witnesses present, which is surely the case at every Orthodox wedding, that's one of the jobs of the Masada Kiddushin, to make sure that there are kosher witnesses present, and it could be in non-Orthodox weddings too, there could be two kosher witnesses. If there are two kosher witnesses and the marriage dissolves, they separate. Each case we will have to evaluate on its own merits. If there are kosher witnesses present and they are halachically married and the marriage dissolves and they get a civil divorce but not a religious get, then from the Torah point of view they are still married because the marriage has not been dissolved in the ritual way with a get. And if she goes and remarries or has relations with another man, the offspring are definitively mamzerim, and that's a serious problem. Okay?
One last thing. So, you know that, for instance, let's say, people that get married in a conservative school, that most probably the witnesses will be from the same community, so therefore they're not Torah observant. So, that marriage is not, according to halakha, is not a marriage.
It's not a valid marriage, correct. Correct. No, but of course it depends upon the rabbi. There are conservative rabbis who are Torah observant. If the rabbi is there and the chazen or someone else who is Torah observant, there are not two Torah observant people.
If they get married in such a way, which is actually not binding on Torah, and then they get a divorce, civil divorce, whatever, and she goes and marries another person and has
the children are okay. The children are okay. The children are all kosher. The children are all kosher. Of course, remember there was that other opinion I mentioned, the Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin absolutely requires a get in every case, and therefore, if it is possible to arrange for a get, of course, every effort should be made to arrange for a get if possible. If we can also fulfill Rav Henkin's opinion, we definitely want to do that. But if it's absolutely impossible to arrange a get, there is this opinion of Rav Moshe Feinstein.
What's the majority of the opinion?
The majority is like Rav Moshe Feinstein.
Yes. If there it's Shabbos and I don't know, you're in a slightly removed location from your family members, and God forbid one of your family members gets hurt and has to go to the hospital, and it's a, I don't know, potentially life-threatening situation. So they've already been taken care of. They have been, you know, driven to the hospital, which is an immediate, you know, commandment, have to violate Shabbos to drive them to the hospital, et cetera, et cetera. So you're in this removed location, and you want to go see that family member because it's a life-threatening situation. What's the halacha? Are you supposed to stay put until Shabbos is over, even though it's
it's permissible for you to violate Shabbos if your violation of Shabbos is going to contribute to life saving. Let me draw a number of pictures of ways in which this might be plausible. Of course, we here cannot establish the facts out there in any given case, but if the facts are as I'm about to describe, then there's some room for leniency. Here's one situation. The family member who is hospitalized is very, very nervous, very upset, very concerned, obviously. And if I drive to the hospital, my presence at the bedside will contribute to the calmness of the patient. Well, anything which will contribute to the calmness of the patient is contributing to life-saving, and that's definitely something which you should do. Whether the facts are as I describe them, well, every case out there is different, and we can't establish here what the facts are out there. But if the facts are that my presence at the bedside will contribute to the calmness of the patient, then that indeed justifies violation of Shabbos in order to go to the hospital. Secondly, if it's true, and again, I don't know what the facts are in any given case, if it's true that I, as a family member in the hospital, shouting or screaming at the medical staff will make them do their jobs better, if it's true that me as a family member riding shotgun over the medical staff will make them do their job better and therefore contribute to life-saving, if that's true, assuming we're in a situation where the medical staff in the hospital is so lackadaisical and negligent and that they're not doing a proper job unless someone is there watching over them, well, then, of course, I'm contributing to life-saving, and that too would justify driving to the hospital. Bottom line, first, you have to figure out the facts. If the facts are that I will contribute to life-saving by violating Shabbos and going to the hospital, then by all means, it's correct to do that. Otherwise, not.
Can you drive back to the hospital?
No, yeah, no, yes, no, 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 yes and no. Depends how frum you are. The rule is as follows. You know, I don't know if I can you handle a little shock? I mean, if the following is too shocking, just ignore it. Okay. One can often, in many circumstances, one can get any answer you want from a rabbi, depending upon how you formulate the question. I will give you an example which will respond to your issue, and you'll see how it works. Back in the old days, the soldiers of David HaMelech, the soldiers of King David, you know, back in those days, the army did not supply weapons to the soldiers. Now you go into the army gives you a rifle. Back in those days, in the days of David HaMelech, the soldiers had to buy their own rifles on the open market and bring their rifles into the army with them. Now, as you know, a rifle is a pretty expensive thing. I mean, those rifles are precision-made instruments, and each one costs a lot of money. And therefore, the soldiers back in the days of David HaMelech had invested a lot of money in their weapons, which they brought into the army with them. Now, there's a war and a battle, and the Jewish soldiers, you know, go out into the battlefield, and the Jews win the battle. It's on Shabbos. They've won the battle. Of course, it was correct to violate Shabbos, to engage the enemy in battle on Shabbos, because that's life-saving for the Jewish people. And now the Jewish army, the army of David HaMelech, won the battle. There's no longer any threat to the Jewish lives. In theory, what the soldiers should do is put down their weapons. Their weapons are now mukta. They have no longer any legitimate reason to handle their weapons. They should put their weapons down on the battlefield as soon as the enemy has declared that they've been vanquished, and go home. And after Shabbos, come back to the battlefield, find their weapons, and take them home. That's what they should do. But of course, if they would do that, they know full well that their weapons are likely to be stolen and will not be there after Shabbos when they come back. And therefore, the halacha, according to the Gemara, is they are permitted to take their weapons home with them after the battle, even though there's no longer any threat to life. They are permitted to take their weapons home with them after battle, because if we would not allow them to do that, if we would require them to drop their weapons in the battlefield, then next time there's a call to arms, next time there's a threat to life and a call to arms, they're going to be very reluctant to bring their weapons with them into the army. And that will lead to loss of life. And therefore, in order to save life in the future, we have to permit them to take their weapons home with them after the battle. Now, that's the halacha as formulated in the Gemara. And now let's see how this applies in contemporary situations. Some applications are simple and straightforward. Think for a moment about the ambulance driver. The ambulance driver is stationed wherever he's stationed. There are a number of stations where ambulance drivers wait to be called. An emergency call comes in. Someone has a heart attack, a stroke, who knows what, an accident, and the ambulance driver gets into his ambulance and drives to the patient for a life-saving procedure. And either the patient is treated at the location, or perhaps the patient has to be taken to the hospital, the ambulance driver does what he has to do in order to try to save the life of the patient. Very nice. Now the ambulance driver has finished his job. The patient has been saved, or maybe the patient died. There is no longer any life-saving here. Either the patient has been saved or died. Now the question is, should the ambulance driver be permitted to drive back to his station in order to be ready for another call? Since it is reasonable to assume, since there's reasonable likelihood that he will be called again for another emergency, all the poskim agree that he can return to his station after having engaged, after having completed his life-saving activity at the moment. Now, that's a fairly simple, straightforward case. Now we come to the complicated cases. Imagine as follows. There are nurses, physicians, surgeons, pharmacists, and so forth and so on, and hospital staff, health caregivers and hospital staff, who work on Shabbos. Any given healthcare provider and hospital staff works a certain number of shifts every month. And in general, some of those shifts fall on Shabbos. And of course, it's entirely correct for the nurse, the physician, or whoever to violate Shabbos in order to save people's lives in the hospital. That's entirely correct and no problem at all. The way it works in the frum hospitals, like Shari Tzedek in Yerushalayim, for example, is a frum hospital. The way it works is they take an old ambulance, which is no longer used for serious cases, doesn't have the equipment to handle serious cases in it. Those old ambulances are usually used just to transport uncomplicated women with uncomplicated labor. Get transported to the hospital in simple ambulances because they know they're not going to need any complicated equipment. So they have those simple ambulances for simple cases. A simple ambulance is driven by a non-Jewish driver, and he has a route, and he drives around Yerushalayim, and all the nurses and the staff who are going to be on the next shift in the hospital stand on the street corner and get picked up by the non-Jewish ambulance driver and get driven to the hospital for the beginning of their shift. Now, this is indeed a violation of Shabbos. The violation of Shabbos has been minimized by having a non-Jewish driver, but it still is prohibited. But it's, of course, correct because they're going to the hospital to save people's lives. Now the shift ends. They were the Friday night shift or the Shabbos morning shift. The shift ends, and it's still Shabbos. Can they get in the next ambulance driver who's going around the same route to pick up the next shift? Can they go back home with him and violate Shabbos on the way home when they finish their shift? They're no longer going to be called upon for life-saving activities at all. Now here, What happens is the following. The nurse, the physician, whoever it is, the physiotherapist, goes to the rabbi, the Torah observant healthcare provider, goes to the rabbi and says, Rabbi, if I work on Shabbat, if I accept a shift in the hospital on Shabbat, which I'm perfectly willing to do to save people's lives, even though it ruins Shabbos for me, but it's important, and that's my profession, and I'm happy to do it. But at the end of the shift, if I have to stay in the hospital until the end of Shabbos, if that's what I have to do, if I can't come home to my family at the end of the shift, then I'm not going to accept work on Shabbos at all. I'd rather not go at all, if that means staying there the whole of Shabbos. Oh, then the rabbi will say, oh, this is just like the soldiers of Beit David. If I tell them that they're not allowed to violate Shabbos after life-saving, so they're not even going to start the life-saving procedure in the first place, of course you can take the ambulance back home after your shift. If, on the other hand, the nurse would say, if what's necessary is I'll just sit in the hospital until Shabbos is over, and then I'll go home, well, then the rabbi will answer, well, that's indeed what you should do. Of course, if you're willing to sit in the hospital until Shabbos is over, that's of course what you should do. Now, of course, it doesn't take long for the nurses and the physiotherapists and the pharmacists and so forth and so on to learn how to formulate their question when they ask the rabbi. If you ask the rabbi the question the right way, you'll get the answer you want. And some people want the firm answer, some people want the more lenient answer, and you can get whatever answer you want depending upon how you ask the question. The facts should govern the halacha, and hopefully the facts are conveyed correctly. Okay, yes.
In the case of marriage, I had two questions on that, because of such a marriage. One is, I heard that even if the two Orthodox Jews are not in the way, you see, for example, a couple going into conflict where they're going to a hotel or something, the conflict marriages, they also call. Is that considered part of the actual marriage ceremony, or is that just...
There are three basic ways in which a marriage can be halachically valid: giving the ring or anything else of value. He gives her something of value. That's one way to complete the marriage ritual. The second way would be with a shtar, a document. He can take a piece of paper, write on the piece of paper, "You are hereby married to me," and give her the piece of paper, a document, and if witnesses observe the giving of the document, that's halakhically the same as witnesses observing the giving of a ring. The third way one can complete the ritual of marriage is through a sexual union, but here it's unlikely that we'd have a situation where witnesses actually see that.
Yeah.
I suppose in some bizarre cases it would be possible, but it's hard to imagine that happens very often.
No,
two people being in private in a room together does not mean they've engaged in sexual congress. No, so two witnesses would have to see that. The two witnesses must be male. They must be over the age of bar mitzvah. They must be Torah observant, not related, and so on and so on. Yeah, as far as the Torah is concerned, men are allowed to have multiple wives, right? If you think about the stories of the Avos, polygamy is, from the Torah point of view, acceptable, and therefore, even if he is not halakhically, ritually divorced, and he remarries, then from the Torah point of view, he has two wives, although we prohibit that, although that is indeed prohibited, it's not a Torah prohibition, and therefore we're not going to get any mamzerim resulting from this. Yes.
The whole question of if it's Shabbos and not holding by either Arabs in the community or there is no Arabs, is there a way to go to the mikvah if the mikvah is a river or a lake? And that's question home with the clothes? Should you minimize the amount of clothing that you wear, etc.?
In theory, not only in theory, it is possible to use a lake, not a river, but it's possible to use a lake as a mikveh on Shabbos, even if there is no Eruv. Remember that in order for a mikveh to be a mikveh, what the word mikveh means is collected standing water. Rain water or melted snow, which feeds a river, is not a mikveh as long as the water is flowing. In order for a mikveh to be a mikveh, the water must be standing water, and therefore a river is not going to be acceptable. A lake is acceptable, assuming what we're talking about is truly a lake. If what looks like a lake and is called a lake is really just a very fat part of a river, all right, a river flows into the lake at one end and flows out of the lake at the other end, then what we're calling a lake is just a very fat part of the river. The water is truly flowing through. That's no good. But if it's truly a lake and the water is not flowing anywhere, it's just standing in the lake, that's okay for a mikveh. And indeed, if it's prohibited to carry there because there's no eruv, then what you could do is stand on the lake, on the side of the lake, on the shore, disrobe, leave your clothes on dry land, go into the water, come out again. Now you're dripping wet. You don't have a towel to dry yourself off. You can sort of like stand in the sun for a while until you dry off, and then you can put your clothes back on and go on your way. If you put your clothes on while you are still wet, you will run the risk of making the clothes wet, obviously. And if the clothes get so wet that handling them in ordinary motions will squeeze water out of the clothes, then that is a prohibition. One is not allowed to squeeze water out of cloth on Shabbos. Of course, if you're only damp, then your clothes are not going to get so wet, and that won't be a problem. If for some reason your clothes have gotten very wet, so you cannot handle them, and you surely cannot carry them home, and now you're in a very difficult situation, aren't you? And therefore, if you want to use a lake as a mikveh on Shabbos in a place where you're not allowed to carry, plan how you're doing this very carefully in a way that you're not going to get into trouble. You cannot carry the clothes home. Stay there. And I hope you planned cleverly enough. Yeah, but he just wants to carry the clothes and not wear them. You can't. I hope you planned this immersion in the lake in a clever enough way that you chose an isolated, private place that you can wait there until it dries, and then you can go home. If you didn't plan carefully, you're really going to be in trouble. Yeah. He can say that he is in danger of catching the swine flu, and people die from that, and then he wants to save his life.
Wedding where you might have two witnesses, even though it's not a kosher wedding. Can the rabbi that's serving as the Messiah Kedushin count as one of those two?
Yeah, sure. You might not believe it, but it's true that many Orthodox rabbis supervise the marriage of two non-religious Jews. Two non-religious Jews come to the Orthodox rabbi. They say, "We want to have a proper Jewish wedding." They invite all their friends. All their friends are not Torah observant. The typical way it's done is the rabbi is Torah observant. The chazan, if there's going to be a chazan, is usually Torah observant. There you have your two witnesses. If there's not going to be a chazan who's Torah observant, the rabbi brings along with him a friend who is Torah observant. There's the rabbi and the friend he brought along with him, probably the only two Torah observant people at the wedding, but that's enough. to do it correctly.
Is it necessary for them to sign on the documents that as the witnesses per se?
No,
or
no. They just have to see. They have to see the giving of the ring. Of course, the ksuba also requires kosher witnesses, and therefore, in a situation like this, it would be the same two witnesses who will sign the ksuba. But the ksuba, of course, might have been signed earlier in a different venue where there were other people who signed. But the ksuba also has to be signed by kosher witnesses. Yeah.
And then what was said earlier, if you have question something or not, then it's not absolutely necessary that you do it. Then should you resist, or you
can still be resisted? No, a safek derabanan, a doubt in a case of rabbinic prohibition is permitted, and that's all there is to it. It's simply permitted.
Okay.
We'll come to it later. Que es su pregunta?
A doctor, let's say, I'm just giving an example of an OBGYN to his patient. First of all, why is he allowed to go deliver a baby on Shabbos in a hospital? Your average hospital, same Monday, has an OBGYN on call 24/7. Why is the woman's specific doctor allowed to go to the hospital and deliver the baby?
That's one question. Let me add to what you say a similar question. If one is in a life-threatening situation, does one have to go to the nearest hospital, or can one go to a more distant hospital? Would be a very similar question. Yes. The answer to these questions is as follows: as long as the Jew is indeed engaging in a life-saving procedure, it is permitted, even if other people could do it. The fact that he's doing it is enough to permit it for him. I'll give you the example of the Gemara, and then I'll give you a modern example that you'll understand how it gets applied. If we have a patient in a life-threatening situation, this is the example of the Gemara, and a doctor comes, and the doctor says, this patient will die unless we can find two dates. Someone has to pluck two dates from a tree in order to save this person. 10 people go out to 10 different trees and pluck the dates and bring them back. They were all correct to do so, right? Because each of them, while they were doing that, was engaging in a life-saving procedure. Even though only two dates were needed, all 10 people were correct to go out, find a date tree, and pluck the dates and bring them. Now consider the following example. The following is a case which happened a few years ago here in Yerushalayim. In one of the big yeshivas over in Givat Shaul, over in Givat Mordechai, a Talmud in the yeshiva was missing on Friday afternoon and was missing. No one knew where he was. His friends and the staff of the yeshiva were quite concerned and contacted the police. And as is normally done in cases like this, the police ask for volunteers who know the missing person. And then teams are established, one friend or acquaintance of the missing person, together with a policeman, are assigned in a grid manner different places to search. And they go out and search, for the person who's missing. The search continued into Shabbos because they couldn't find the person and they were afraid for a life-threatening situation. And so here we have, quite correctly, a large number of policemen and civilians driving around Yerushalayim in specific quadrants, following specific routes, looking for the missing person. Quite correct to violate Shabbos in this way. Leil Shabbos, Friday night, the person was found, the missing person was found in jail. The person had been arrested and was in jail, and that's why he did not come back to the yeshiva. And because of some mix-up in identifying the person. He was not carried with his proper name on the jail attendance list, and that's why the police could not find him. One of the places the police, of course, check for missing people is not only in hospitals. One of the places the police check for missing people is in jails. An error had been made in his identity number on the computer, and therefore they didn't find him the first time in the jail where he really was. In any event, Friday night he was found safe and sound in jail. And now the question arises, what about all those teams out there still looking for him, all of them violating Shabbos moment by moment? Should we send out people by foot to look for those policemen and civilians and tell them, forget it, from now on it's okay, just get out of the car and walk back to the yeshiva, there's no longer any threat to life? Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was consulted on this case, and he opined that it's exactly the same as the situation I described before in the Gemara. Since all of these teams went out for a life-saving purpose, it's just like the 10 people who went out to pluck dates from trees. What they're doing is correct, and since what they're doing is correct, there's no reason at all to tell them to stop.
How is it like that? In the case where the dates, they'll bring the dates to stay alive.
Yeah, but as soon as the first two dates were brought, there's no need to send out runners and tell all the other people, if you haven't plucked the dates yet, don't.
Well, that's the case in the Gemara, after they brought the
case, if that were required, the Gemara should have told us that little fact, which happens to be terribly important. But since the Gemara is silent on that, we conclude that it's correct for them to continue plucking, going out looking for a date, even though it's quite possible, and that dates have already been provided, and runners could have been sent out to tell them, but there's no need to send out runners such as that. Okay.
So if you want to establish the truth of something, then you know, how far do you have to go to find out?
As far as you can go. If it's a doubt on Shabbos, of course you cannot go further than Tchum Shabbos. You're not allowed to leave your city on Shabbos. So you couldn't go further than that in order to resolve the doubt. If it's during a weekday, you could go further.
How long, as far as this is, how long do you have to go to find out?
As long as it's possible to establish the facts, you must establish the facts. If it is impossible to establish the facts, then you can rely upon the leniency in a rabbinic situation. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, you might not even be allowed to sit down.
Right.
Right.
So is there any
way
that you should be staying at home if you know it's
raining outside? No. Assuming for a moment that your clothing is so wet that you can't even sit down without squeezing water out of your clothing, then there is definitely some room for a chumrah here. There's definitely some room to prohibit that. There are, on the other hand, some poskim who do hold that since squeezing water out of clothing is only a rabbinic prohibition and not a Torah prohibition, right? Squeezing juice from a grape or oil from an olive, that's a Torah prohibition. But squeezing liquid from a garment is only a rabbinic prohibition. And since you are mit'asek means you have no intention to squeeze the water out, you are engaged in a different activity. You are engaged in the activity of sitting down in a chair. That's what you want to do. And incidentally, the squeezing of the water results. There are many poskim who are lenient in this case. Similarly, in the previous case, if your clothing is soaking wet and just walking is going to squeeze out some water, many poskim are lenient for exactly the same reasons. Umbrella?
I
umbrella. The umbrella. Yes, in Hebrew, mitria. An umbrella. I know umbrellas. Noted in English as a brolly. The rule is as follows. You are correct that it is a rabbinic prohibition to open up an umbrella. Creating a roof is a rabbinic prohibition of building. It's not really a structure, I understand. It's only a roof. And therefore, it's only a rabbinic prohibition and not a Torah prohibition. But opening an umbrella definitely is a Torah prohibition on Shabbos. Since opening the umbrella is a rabbinic prohibition, closing the umbrella is equally a rabbinic prohibition. Wherever it is prohibited to build a wall, it is equally prohibited to raise.
Utilizing it itself is the Torah prohibition.
It's a rabbinic prohibition, the umbrella. The umbrella is a rabbinic prohibition to open and close. Now, today, in from Torah observant communities, it is absolutely, completely, and definitively unheard of to use umbrellas on Shabbos, and therefore I cannot in good conscience advise anyone to do that. However, I know full well that not so long ago it was very common for Torah observant Jews to use umbrellas on Shabbos. Back in the good old days, in Frankfurt, a big city in Germany, before the Holocaust, before World War II, with rainy weather predicted, the Torah observant Jews would open their umbrellas before Shabbos, leave their open umbrellas ready and available before Shabbos. On Shabbos morning or Shabbos night, whenever, they would take their open umbrella, walk through the streets with their open umbrella. There was an Eruv, so there was no problem of carrying there. They would arrive to shul, hand the umbrella to the non-Jewish, wie sagt man, Abwart? The non-Jewish man, not a Shabbos goy, he's the doorkeeper. What do you keep, a doorkeeper? Okay, you hand the umbrella to him. He would close the umbrella, put it aside. After shul, when you're walking out again, he would fetch your umbrella, open it, and hand it to you, and you would walk back home and leave it open at home until after Shabbos. That was quite common before World War II in many communities. Well, it's not frum, you know. Umbrellas are not frum. Because it's a roof. But the prohibition is not carrying the umbrella. The prohibition is opening it or closing it. Now, of course, anything that we're prohibited from doing on Shabbos, or b'chol ha-Torah kula, anything we're prohibited from doing, we cannot ask a goy to do either. The only reason it's permissible for the goy in the shul to close the umbrella and then open it again before returning it to the Jewish customer, the only reason that's permitted is because, as far as the Jew is concerned, the non-Jew can leave the umbrella open. The only reason the goy is closing the umbrella and opening it again is for the goy's convenience, to make it easier for him to store the things and deal with it. As far as we're concerned, he doesn't have to do that at all. Since he's not doing the opening and closing for us, he's doing it for his own convenience, his own purposes, so there's no reason for us to object to that. He's closing it and opening it to make life easier for himself, to make his own work easier. As far as we're concerned, he doesn't have to do that. He can just leave it open. Mucha luvia ahí? Se dice ahí luvia o lluvia?
Lluvia.
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 Lluvia. Lluvia. Lluvia.
Carrying an umbrella. I told her,
No, no, no. We are not allowed to benefit. We are not allowed to benefit from violation of Shabbat. If a Jew violates Shabbat, if a Jew heats water on Shabbat, we are not allowed to drink from that water, from that tea or coffee. If a Jew violates Shabbat, we are not allowed to benefit from that. That's exactly what's happening here. And therefore, no, one should not benefit from the umbrella which has been opened. Yeah?
So what about then the case of watching someone picking through food and
No. A Jew who violates the prohibition of Borer, separating the bad and good food in a prohibited way, one is not allowed to eat the food which results from that. What? If it was B'shogeg, then after Shabbos it's okay to benefit from it, but not on Shabbos.
We have here a water fountain which comes into the wall, and some sort of refrigeration thing happens. Usually it's unplugged. A couple weeks ago, it's not unplugged on Shabbos. Is it a problem for you?
Maybe. The rule is like this.
Not as follows?
As follows. There are two possibilities. Either, possibility number one, drawing water out of it will secretia inevitably turn on the refrigeration unit, in which case you're not allowed to take water out because that's turning on the refrigeration unit, or taking water out sometimes does and sometimes does not turn on the refrigeration unit. So you can experiment during the week and see what the facts are. If the fact, listen, you can hear when it clicks on. If taking out water always clicks on the refrigeration unit, it's definitely usher to do that on Shabbos. If, on the other hand, sometimes it clicks on, sometimes it doesn't, you're okay. No different than opening the front door to a house where the heating or cooling system in the house is controlled by a central thermostat. In a large house, opening the front door will not necessarily turn on the heating or cooling system. In a small room, on the other hand, the facts might be different. It might be that every time you open the door, the heating system or cooling system clicks on. If those are the facts, then you're not allowed to open the door on Shabbos. Okay?
I would want to think about a Chabad Shita on the Chabad halakhic approach and wearing watches on Shabbos. Under the impression it's prohibited, it is permitted.
Talking about the problem of carrying in the public domain or the problem of muktzah because of electricity?
Well, not even electricity. The possibility of it breaking and becoming muktzah during use. Lots of issues. But I know it's permitted by certain authorities. So I was wondering if you use a Chabad.
I'm unfamiliar with the minhag of Chabad on this issue, but if you find that, let me know.
Well, am I right about it is permitted by...
To wear a watch, if we're talking about carrying the watch, wearing the watch in the public domain, in a place where there is no Eruv, most poskim prohibit that on Shabbos, because the watch is only a kli tashmish, something which you want to use as a watch. And that's why it's prohibited to wear it in the public domain on Shabbos. If, on the other hand, the watch is not only a kli tashmish, not only something you want to use as a watch, but is also decorative jewelry. You spent a lot of money for the watch. A small fraction of the money you spent is for an operating watch. All the other money that you spent is for a nice watch which is a piece of jewelry as well. If it's an act of, a piece of jewelry, then just as one is allowed to go in the public domain with jewelry, so the watch would count as that. A good guideline would be, oh, you're all boys, so I don't know if you can understand this. There you've got it. Okay, but girls. Girls, if you, I know you get the following you might find unusual. Girls are happy to wear broken watches, whether the watch works or not. It doesn't matter in the slightest. They don't wear the watch because they want to know what time it is. They wear the watch because it is a piece of jewelry. Now if you think about it, when you come to buy a watch for your fiance or your wife, you will be you will be surprised to discover that they sell special watches for women where the numbers in the hands are so tiny that you can't see them. They're just totally unusable as watches. But boys, men's watches are of a size where it's easy to see the numbers in the hands. Girls' watches are made, they're just not usable because girls don't care about that. All they want is a piece of jewelry on their wrist. Now, bottom line.
What about broken mukta?
But bottom line, if there is a jewelry element, then you're off the hook. It's okay to carry it, wear it in the public domain without an eruv. Next, what about the muktzah question in the house or outside if there is an eruv? As long as it is a functioning watch, there is no problem in carrying it within the eruv or surely within the house. If, on the other hand, it breaks and is not of jewelry value, then it is muktzah. The rule of something mukta is as follows. If something mukta, whether it's a watch or a pen, if it has legitimately come into my hand on Shabbos, right, the goy placed it in my hand, or it's been in my hand since before Shabbos, like the watch has been on my wrist since before Shabbos, if it has legitimately come into my hand or onto my wrist, and it's mukta, I need not drop it at the nearest location. I can go calmly to a place where I want it to be, and I can put the muktzah item down in a place where I want it to be until Shabbos is over. I need not put it down in the first place available. Similarly, the watch, if the watch breaks, you need not take it off and drop it immediately. You can go to a convenient place and put it down there.
On the first thing about the use of the watch as a jewelry versus a usable watch in the public domain. If it's in the middle, people go to mikvah, and they don't hold by the eruv, or there is no eruv, but often tie the towel around their waist.
Yeah.
Problematic?
Yeah, if there's no eruv, it's highly problematic. If there's no eruv, you know,
what?
Oh, it's a scarf. That's okay. Scarf is an article of clothing.
Oh, but now let's say it's the middle of the summer,
mm-hmm.
and you are not using it as a scarf in any way.
No problem. Even in the middle of the summer, there's no problem in wearing a heavy winter coat. What makes it a garment is not that at the moment it's hot or cold outside. It is inherently a garment. And indeed, even in the middle of the summer, you can wear two or three heavy winter coats on top of each other. Each is a garment, and you are wearing each. The fact that you don't need it at the moment, because it's not cold, has nothing to do with it. It is a garment, and this is the way it's worn.
So you're not violating the law, or you're just crazy?
Correct. Well, you might have some rational reasons for what you're doing.
I just want to ask one last question for the umbrella situation. Let's say you open up the umbrella before Shabbos started. Are you building a roof by physically lifting it over your head? Is that
no.
Building
a roof? No. Cause it always was a roof. When you put the umbrella on the floor, the handle of the umbrella on the floor, and part of the circumference of the umbrella lying on the floor, it is now also a roof. And therefore, picking it upright is not created rabbinic prohibition at all.
I don't understand why it's a problem now if you're not creating a roof.
If it's closed, you have no roof at all. If it's open but lying on the floor, so you have a little bit of coverage of a roof.
So there would be a problem putting it back down on Shabbos.
Closing it. If you hold the umbrella, if you hold the umbrella and put it on the floor, and as I indicated to you, that's what they used to do before World War II. But I also indicated that since today this is absolutely, completely, and totally unheard of in any Torah observant community, so I cannot, in good conscience, advise you to do it. But there's really nothing wrong. There's really nothing wrong with it.
There is nothing wrong with it,
but it's not done, and I cannot in good conscience advise you to fly in the face of community practice.
I want to specify the situation for a bit, not even Bora, and we're speaking about something a little bit different. Okay, so the situation is there's a chong pot, and someone's going to be serving the chong from the chong pot. But in order to get to the pizza with the chong that they want, they push the undesirable things, say the beans and potatoes, and then there's some meat in the corner of the pot. So they go ahead and they take the spoon, they push away what they don't want, or they even scoop away what they don't want, leave it in the pot itself, they grab the meat, and they put it onto their plate.
It's okay to eat. Look, lechatchila, I would strongly advise against doing what this person did in serving the chulent. But I was not consulted, and yesh alma l'smoch, there is what to rely upon to permit what they're doing. And the rule in deriving benefit from Shabbos violation is as follows. If the person did what they did, relying upon any opinion at all, even though I reject that opinion absolutely, if they choose to rely upon a certain opinion and do what they do, they are not sinning by relying upon that opinion, even though I reject that opinion. And since they're not sinning, there's no reason to impose any penalty on using the result of what they're doing. So even though I would tell them not to do it, since they have what to rely upon, the food remains permitted.
They don't have to
be a Talmud Chacham, and they don't have to be able to name the poskim or the tshuva number that they're relying upon. It's sufficient that it exists. Okay? In this particular case, it could be construed as derech achila, and therefore mutter. So, we're running out of time. We're going to pause with this. I wish you a good Shabbos and a good week, and if Yitzhak Hashem, we'll continue next week.